Pope Leo XIV releases his first apostolic exhortation of his pontificate, Dilexit Te, focusing on the love and care of the poor. The Papal Posse, Father Gerald Murray and Robert Royal join me with analysis and reaction. President Donald Trump announces a new peace deal between Israel and Hamas. Will it last? And what does it entail? Foreign policy and Middle East expert Dr. Waleed Faris weighs in. And actor Devon Franklin shares his inspirational new movie, Soul on Fire. The world over begins right now.
Now, Raymond DeRoy.
A warm welcome to all of you joining us in the United States and the world over. An important show for you this week. If you'd like to comment, send me an X post. I'm at Raymond Arroyo and at Arroyo Grande Show on YouTube. Pope Leo just released his first apostolic exhortation, Dilexit Te, I Have Loved You, which focuses on the poor. Coupled with his recent comments, it's already sparking a lot of conversation. Here with insight and analysis is the Papal Posse, editor-in-chief of thecatholicthing.org, Robert Royal, and canon lawyer and priest of the Archdiocese of New York, Father Gerald Murray. Gentlemen, thank you for being here. Pope Leo signed this exhortation, the translation is, I have loved you, on the feast of St. Francis of Assisi. Father, Pope Francis had been working on this text of this exhortation just before he passed away, and Pope Leo took it up and finished it. Another example of continuity from the last pontificate, at least from the Vatican's perspective. Your thoughts?
Yes, this is, it reminds me when John Paul II came, he continued the document of catechesis that John Paul I had been working on. And that became Catechesi Tridente. So it is something that popes have done. They continue the work. In this case, though, it's obviously a document that reflected Pope Francis's focus on the poor and on a church of the poor and for the poor, and then trying to set forth the theological, scriptural, and then also current affairs bases of what Pope Francis was writing about. Now that becomes Pope Leo's teaching. So it is a continuity, and it's kind of an indication that Pope Leo is very much interested that the agenda that Pope Francis had laid out, there be follow-through on it during the new pontificate.
Well, someone who read this, whom I spoke with this morning in the Vatican, said, we thought we were getting an American pope, but we got the second Latin American pope. And it does have that flavor when you read it. It does have a kind of perspective on economics and the world situation, which we'll get into. The text certainly builds on the social teaching of the church over the last century or so. Pope Leo XIII's Rerum Novarum. And in it, Leo writes that, the new Leo, the poor are not just objects of charity, they are also evangelists who can inspire conversion. Bob, how do you see Leo's exhortation in relation to Rerum Novarum as the bedrock of modern Catholic social teaching, particularly the issue of poverty and the poor, which the church has always given voice to?
Yeah, I mean, look, it's a very heartfelt and I ought to say repetitive and long text yeah. about how the church is centrally focused on the poor, how we have an obligation toward the poor, how we learn from the poor. Yeah. But I think this moves quite a bit of distance away from Leo XIII.
Oh.
Because Leo XIII is looking at socialism. He's coming down the line and he knows that both in terms of how it views human beings and how it views social structures, that it's mistaken, that what we really need is Christianity, respect for the dignity of people, workers, etc.
Yeah.
This really moves in a very different direction, where the poor, it's very hard to say who the poor are in this text, because it's people who are deprived, or people who are excluded. It says right near the beginning that the poor are growing throughout the world, which is false, by the way.
Really?
Yes. Yeah, so, I mean, we know from, I mean, look, numbers are not everything in this regard, but we know from World Bank statistics, which everyone uses to try to gauge where are we going with economies, that since 1990, the number of poor in the world has declined. It was a billion and a half in 1990.
Okay.
Today it's about 775 million. So it's a half. And that during a period when the global population grew by over 2.5 billion. So look, we haven't solved the problem of poverty in the world. It's good for the church to talk about how we have obligations with the poor and how we learn about what Christianity is from how we treat the weakest among us.
Yeah.
But at the same time, I think it doesn't have a realistic appraisal of where we are. We're not in a perfect circumstance, but certainly a lot of what I think the Vatican doesn't like, which is to say capitalism, technological developments, those things have really had enormous consequences that have helped the poor out of poverty.
Yeah, and that's barely mentioned. Yeah, the categories of the poor are odd here, Father. I mean, they talk about, you know, migrants who aren't welcomed, people who don't feel welcomed by their community. Heck, Father, I didn't realize I was poor my whole life. I mean, I got a ton of people that don't welcome me. But here's an excerpt from Delexite, this new exhortation from Pope Leo. I want to get your reaction. It says in one point, we need to be increasingly committed to resolving the structural causes of poverty. And then it says, Father, the preferential option for the poor is invoked once again. He says, there are those who say our task is to pray and teach sound doctrine, separating this religious aspect from integral development. They even say that it's the government's job to care for them, or that it would be better not to lift them out of their poverty, but simply teach them to work. At times, pseudoscientific data are invoked to support the claim that a free market economy will automatically solve the problem of poverty. Well, Father, I mean, that's what Bob was talking about. It actually did.
Yeah, well, there's a lot there in those statements. Certainly, just start at the end where you say pseudoscientific, but pseudoscientific according to whom? Because there are plenty of people who have written studies based on what Bob is talking about to show that where free market economy is thriving and is legally recognized and guaranteed, that you have development. And I would take just perfect examples, post-war Japan, Korea, India. These countries in the Far East and in Asia have shown that if there's a rule of law and prosperity results when people are given the opportunity to work and to keep their earnings. Where have things failed? It's usually socialist countries. And that's one thing I noted in reading this document. The critiques and the blame casting is all in the direction of free market countries. And as I say, you know, to different people, very few people get on boats from Miami to travel down to Havana. It's just the other way around. And there's a reason for that. I've been to Havana. I went there in 98 when John Paul II was there. The communists destroyed a prosperous country with an economic system supposed to help the poor. And so all the poor Cubans who can get out and come to Florida. And by the way, Florida's developed so many aspects of Cuban life. When Cuba becomes free, there's going to be a whole set of people who go back and rebuild the country.
That is kind of omitted from the document. The power of free markets and free people, a free society. And it is, Bob, is it moving towards socialism? I mean, you talked about Pope Leo. I just read a whole document by Pius XII, you know, condemning socialism, condemning communism. That seems to be forgotten. The most quoted pope in the footnotes here is Pope Francis. So he was essentially quoting himself, and then I guess they added other footnotes from his documents.
Yeah. Well, look, it isn't very clear what this document is driving towards, because it's one thing to say that capitalism doesn't automatically lead to the solution of poverty. Mm-hmm. Obviously, that's true. There are problems with capitalism like there are problems with everything human. The same is true of technologies. There's a positive side to technologies and there's a negative side. But if you talk to most developmental experts, what they'll tell you is this. There are basically three reasons why poverty isn't solved in a given country. Usually it's because there's an ineffective or corrupt government. There's no legal system, as Father was talking about, that is really effective. Or second, there's warfare, or there's either around the country or within the country. And third, it's culture. If you don't have a culture of entrepreneurship and, you know, looking forward and invention and trying to solve problems, how are you going to move from where you are to something else? So look, in the world today, the biggest problem, I mean, Latin America itself has undergone tremendous development, the reductions in poverty. COVID has changed the numbers a little bit everywhere in the world, but there's indications that actually development has worked in those kind of places. The place where the worst problems are in sub-Saharan Africa, because you've got the problem of, you know, basically countryside that doesn't lend itself to development. It's hard to know how you move from the cultures that are there that are largely agrarian to, you know, something different. How do you bring in electricity? All those things that are quite important.
And so, the great unsaid China, who is exploiting you know, cold clearing all of their natural resources in Africa, exploiting the people. There's not one mention of China here,
right,
or countries going in and exploiting poorer countries. And again, why? Why not?
Well, and if you're going to talk about structural sins or structural barriers to people developing, it isn't necessarily capitalism. There's a reason why the Scandinavian countries, which are very capitalist, are prosperous.
Yeah.
It's because they value what is good, but they also enclose it, as John Paul II told us, within a moral and religious kind of vision of right and wrong, and it embodies it in the legal system.
Yeah.
And that is what we need more than anything else if we're going to deal with poverty.
Father, I read it. I tried to read it as charitably as I could when I read through this document. And for me, the takeaway was, if you get away from, you know, some of the clumsy analysis and kind of biased view of certain markets, and look, it's very anti-American. We have to say it. I'll just say it. I found it very anti-American in its ethos, which alienates the people who need to hear it most, because the heart of the message is, you have to go out and serve the poor. We each have to go and do our part to serve the poor among us, you know, which I remember Mother Teresa telling me about. That seemed to be the thrust of this, but it was wrapped in all of this other analysis.
Well, there is an absolute obligation for every Christian to serve their neighbor, and particularly the poor, and we should do that. But the social teaching of the church goes beyond that. What it's trying to do is establish for governments and people of influence, what are the conditions for personal freedom and thriving in a society? And they include what we've been talking about, the rule of law. They include popular education so that people can learn and can function in the new economies. But they don't include something that, sad to say, is the dream of the leftist, which is a government-controlled economy, a command economy, which will tell people what everything costs, where they can work, how much they can own. That's the nightmare the communism brought to Russia, China, Eastern Europe, North Korea, Cuba, Nicaragua. All of those places suffered as a result of these false economic ideas.
Yeah. I want to move on to an issue that Leo seems to break with his predecessor on. That would be Vatican financial policy. On Monday, Pope Leo reversed a 2022 law that declared the management of the Holy See's assets was an exclusive responsibility of the Institute of Religious Works. That was Leo's first executive decree, and it stipulates that non-Vatican banks in other countries can be used if the Vatican's investment committee deems it more efficient or convenient to do so. Previously, asset management was the domain of the Holy See's patrimony office, so the 2022 law seemed to contradict the Vatican's own constitution. Father, what does this really mean for the management of Vatican assets, and how significant a break is this from the Francis model?
No, I think it's a good development, because the Vatican, the Good Works organization at the Vatican, is in its essence, it's a small bank. They're not capable of doing all of the investing and interactions with different marketplaces. And likewise, any good financial advisor will tell you, you need to diversify your holdings, and you need to have competing money managers so that you get your best results. So I think what they're doing is recognizing that it's the centralized control on the out of a small bank in Vatican City State. That's not the best way in a world economy to invest the monies that the Holy See is coming into in the different properties and other assets. So I think it's a big improvement.
Well, with all the scandals, I mean, Bob, you would think, you know, kind of bringing things, letting the Vatican handle its own business might be the good thing rather than extending it into these other opportunities. I mean, this is how they got into the London real estate deal.
Well, look, the Vatican Bank, the Institute for Religious Works, generally speaking, most people think of that as reliable. It is now under a certain transparency under European banking rules. So that part of it seems to be have been reformed properly. Pope Francis, I hear this from people who are involved in charitable organizations in the church, that a few years ago they tried to get all the monies, you know, even some of these peripheral groups like Age of the Church in Need, to get all the monies in the hands of Rome. And you can understand why they tried to do that, because there was so much corruption and they were, you know, worried about what was going on. But there's the secondary question of how does the Vatican solve its financial problems? They've got a $1.5 billion hangover for the pensions of Vatican workers. And so there's been a lot of speculation about what they're trying to do with this new rule. It's clear at the very least that what they're trying to do is to free themselves up to make a little bit more money in a more, let's say, reliable way than they did in the past. And a lot of this is going to depend on who's making those decisions and what the decisions are, because we know that once people get to the capability of moving money around, corruption is possible, but we can hope that the oversight is going to be better than it was in the past.
Okay. After recently referencing the inhuman treatment of immigrants in the United States, Pope Leo was asked this question.
Yes. President Trump has sent 400 National Guard troops to your city, Chicago.
Yes. I prefer not to comment at this time about choices made, political choices within the United States. Thank you very much.
Well, when I heard that, Father, I thought, this is wise. The Pope shouldn't be a pundit, and he shouldn't be pulled into politics by hungry journalists. Then he waded into the immigration debate in the U.S., had a meeting with El Paso Bishop Mark Seitz, the chair of the USCCB's Migration Committee, and immigration activists assembled as well. Bishop Seitz shared letters from immigrant families who feel, quote, terrorized by ICE raids and immigration enforcement. Pope Leo even teared up at one point, reportedly telling Seitz, the church cannot stay silent before injustice. You stand with me and I stand with you. Here's a bit of their exchange.
I was struck at the beginning, it talks about the feeling of powerlessness, which I think is so much I think it's so important that we as church give a message of hope in the midst of these horrible struggles, what's going on in so many cities in the United States right now, that it just, I mean, at least the church cannot be silent.
You've spoken very strongly, and, you know, we're trying to do the same in our country, and yet not get into the political fray the best that we can.
I know, even within the conference, there are challenges there. That's one place that should be. I wish there were stronger voices.
Bob, your reaction to this very pointed political posture from the Holy See now?
Well, look, we all see some troubling elements in the way that now, because there have been so many illegals allowed into the country, that ICE and other enforcement have to deal with this. And, you know, when you see that, or if there's an abusive member of ICE or something, it's a problem and it ought to be dealt with. Just like if a policeman loses his temper, we deal with that. But it doesn't invalidate the fact that this country has a responsibility to enforce its immigration laws. And I'm sorry to say about Leo, because I kind of have a favorable impression of him, but I think he's being propagandized a little bit by some of the elements in our bishops' conference, because there's more than one moral element at stake here. Yes, it's true that some people are frightened about this because they've done something illegal. They've come to the country not through the legal means that are provided by the government. Should we have more people coming legal? That's a political debate that our Congress can have. But to look at this and put all the blame solely on a effort at law enforcement, when in fact there's a larger question about the country, when we have our own people who are suffering. Look, the government is shut down right at this moment, largely over the question of, are illegals going to get
Healthcare.
Free health care?
Yeah.
when our own people are struggling to pay for health care. So it's a complicated moral situation, and I wish that somehow Leo could get a broader picture with all the moral elements that are in play, because it's not solely what came out of that conversation.
Mm. Father, your reaction, I mean, as Bob said, he's saying the church cannot stay silent before injustice. Is enforcing standing U.S. immigration law unjust?
No, it isn't, because the Catholic Church recognizes the right of every country to regulate its borders. In other words, who enters, who gets to stay, who only has a temporary stay, a visitor's visa or whatever. So people who violate the law to obtain a benefit that they're not entitled to, when the law is enforced, they have to leave. And there's nothing unjust in that. It can be done, of course, in a way that's inhumane if it was, you know, rounding people up and putting them, you know, in pain to get out. But that's not what's done. Only people who resist arrest by ICE are going to be subject to some kind of, you know, enforcement through physical restraint. So it's a very emotional thing to say someone who came here illegally and is enjoying life in America has to leave, and that's unjust. It's not unjust. The person knows they're here without legal permission. They ran that risk. They didn't get online and wait to come in legally. They did it otherwise. So, you know, I can sympathize with people saying, well, you know, it's not nice to have police going into towns. But guess what? If you don't have police, you're not going to have a town.
Yeah.
We have to have order. These rioters, by the way, seem to get all the sympathy in the media because they're going against what they call, you know, the fascist police of ICE. No, that's propaganda they're putting out to justify their behavior. They should also be arrested when they commit illegal acts.
Yeah. But Father, now you have, and what's this is all going to be used, I will tell you, to give moral suasion and moral weight to the arguments that somehow ICE is a renegade, you know, this is the Stasi going on the street collecting people, when in reality, these are people, in some cases, and the people in this first wave, these are criminal elements for the most part. These are people with criminal records, visa overstays, and they left the country and came back illegally. And then you have people who are part of these cartel networks. I dare say the crime happening in the city, the things happening in U.S. cities, are cartel organizations that have networks from the border all the way up the United States. If that were happening in the Vatican, one would hope that the message should be, we need to get criminality off of our streets and out of our country. That's not happening at the Vatican. I mean, it's not.
Look, we know that even one of the principal generals in ICE has been threatened by a Mexican cartel. They put out a contract on him to have him killed. Mm-hmm. I mean, how can you have a more obvious example of what the dynamic is in the country? It is not simply a matter of innocent people who are going about their lives who are being picked up by law enforcement. So, look, I want to say again, it's complicated. We allowed far too many people into the country. There are a lot of people in that group of people who are pretty bad dudes, as our president has said. Yeah. And so when you go in and you enforce the law, it's going to be rough and tumble at some points. But I don't know what the alternative is. Either we go in and take them out, or they continue to terrorize
our
people.
Bob, the church, and Father, the church teaches people have a right to migrate, but a country doesn't have a necessarily an obligation to accept you. I mean, the organized immigration processes, that is the obligation and the right of any state. And I thought that's what the church always taught.
No, the church does teach that. And, you know, the emotional appeal is going with a premise that's unstated, which is they're stating, well, U.S. immigration law is unjust because everybody should be allowed into the country whenever they want. Well, if you believe that, then you got to influence the legislators to change the law. Because the American people historically have had laws to regulate who gets in and who gets thrown out when they overstay their visa. So, no, the church reckon, look, Vatican City State last year, they issued a decree about what to do with people who enter the state illegally and want to, you know, stay on the grounds without permission. And they are subject to arrest.
And fines.
So the Vatican, it's okay to arrest people if they, you know, camp out in the Vatican Gardens, but it's not okay to arrest them if they enter the country illegally and will refuse to leave.
Yeah, good point. At his Sunday Mass for the Jubilee of Migrants, Pope Leo urged Catholics to care for immigrants so they are not faced with what he called the coldness of indifference or the stigma of discrimination. Pope Leo also met recently with the Director General of the International Organization for Migration, Amy Pope. The two both expressed mutual support for migrants the world over. And Bob, when Supich was trying to wiggle out of his scandalous plan to grant Senator Durbin a church honor, he said, "We are not a one-issue church," but it does feel like immigration is becoming that one issue in Rome.
Yeah. Look, and the Catholic principle that is often invoked here is human dignity. Now, you know, of course, every human person is a child of God, man and woman, boy and girl, wherever they're from, wherever they're going to. But that's not a policy for immigration and migration around the world. And it's curious, in light of what we said about this new apostolic exhortation, where do migrants want to go? They want to go to precisely those countries where capitalism and the rule of law and technologies are producing wealth, because it's a better place to live than where they're coming
those
from.
Those terrible inhuman places.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things that needs to be done in terms of human dignity, and I heard this actually during the Synod on young people, is if the young people, the most dynamic, the most intelligent, the most promising part of your population migrate to Europe or to the United States or, you know, wherever they want to go, Australia, what is going to happen to those countries, to their systems that are left behind, their economies, their political systems, their cultural systems? There has to be part of the humanity of this situation is to make it less urgent for people to migrate in the first place.
Right.
I mean, they talk a lot about how climate change has produced this way. And climate has almost nothing to do with migration.
Yeah.
It has everything to do with political situations, economic situations, and so forth. So, look, migration is going to be on our radar for a long time in the near future, because there are lots of people who want to come to the developed world. But we can't take a kind of Johnny one-note approach to this very large problem.
Yeah. In a related story, Father, another U.S. bishop is considering suspending the Sunday obligation to attend Mass in his diocese for Catholics who find themselves afraid of ICE raids and arrests. Archbishop Jeffrey Grob of Milwaukee raised the possibility in a recent interview, where he also said he had no issue with ordaining women as priests or deacons, but cannot do so with the current strictures of the Catholic Church. Father, is Archbishop Grob justified in suspending Sunday Mass obligations for allegedly frightened migrants?
I don't think so, because people who are here illegally, and that's the category, it's not all migrants. So people who are here illegally know that they don't have a legal basis to remain in the country. So they're anytime, any place, they're subject to arrest, because if ICE knows where they are, or finds out, then they can arrest them. So if they've chosen to go about their lives and go to work and go to the park and go to the movies, they can also go to Mass.
Yeah.
Now, the other thing is that Archbishop Grob said that he has no problem ordaining women.
Yeah.
Well, wait a minute. You're a bishop of the Catholic Church. The Catholic Church teaches it's impossible to ordain a woman. So why would you do something that's impossible? You know, bishops take an oath to uphold the Catholic faith when they become bishops. The bishop needs to reexamine and reject this position, because the issue is not what do I like, what would I prefer. The issue is what did Jesus and what does the church say? And the church says very solemnly, Jesus only ordained men, the church will only ordain men.
Yeah, that bishop treats the priesthood with the same fungibility he treats borders, I guess. They're all subject to change depending on social attitudes. Meanwhile, at the Vatican, the vice prefect of the Vatican Library has announced the establishment of a prayer space for Muslims who visit the Vatican Apostolic Library in Vatican City. In an interview with La Repubblica, published October 8th, the vice prefect, Giacomo Cardinale, says, "Of course, some Muslim scholars have asked us for a room with a carpet for praying, and we have given it to them." Bob, this is kind of like the blessing of the block of ice last week. I mean, the satire kind of writes itself. Why do this? Why do this?
Yeah. Well, look, I think if you ask them, they would say, well, as Christians, you know, we need to facilitate other people. We respect them. We respect their religions, et cetera. And that's all well and good.
Yeah.
But that doesn't mean that you have to provide space for them in the Vatican
to
library
worship.
to worship a God who is not actually our God. And in fact, we're dealing with Islam, which for me, I think more and more is becoming an explosive issue inside the Catholic Church itself, because we just celebrated the victory at Lepanto the other day.
Yes.
We know that because of the victory over the Turks in Vienna, that Vienna did not become Muslim, although it's more and more becoming Muslim these days.
They're catching up.
They say that in the public schools in Austria, the Muslim children outnumber actually now native Austrians.
Wow.
So, look, Islam is a militant religion. To welcome them in may satisfy certain people who have certain views of what Christianity is. I think for most Muslims, they look at that and they say, oh, that's nice, they're weak.
Mm. Father, do you think they're going to build a special chapel for you to say Mass at Mecca?
No chance of that, and I wouldn't even ask for it. In fact, it's a little presumptuous of the scholars to ask for this prayer room. You know, they go out to lunch. They could also take time to go outside and pray. So, what can I say?
Yeah, there's nothing more to say about this.
Bending over backwards to appear to be ecumenical. Well, the answer is the library is a place you go to study, accomplish that task, and then leave to do other things.
Yeah. The prefect of the DDF, Cardinal Victor Manuel Fernandez, is denying that his dicastery approved a same-sex blessing guide drawn up by the Catholic Church in Germany. The president of the German Bishops' Conference, Cardinal Georg Betzig, has claimed that the controversial guide issued during the papal interregnum had been created transparently in consultation with the dicastery. Fernandez is now telling the Pillar that didn't happen. They didn't approve anything regarding such a text or guide. And he maintains that he sent the German bishops a letter reminding them that a ritualization is not possible according to Fiducia Supplicans. Bob, again, we come to this ambiguous teaching and messaging. Does Fernandez's denial hold water?
Well, I don't know that I trust either side in this controversy, because clearly there's a lot of self-interest on both sides. It could very well be that there was just a difference of interpretation of what was actually said at the time. That would be a very generous interpretation, I think, of what's going on. I have to think that the Vatican, even Fernandez at this point, is wary enough about this controversy that he would be cautious about actually approving something like that. And then maybe there is just the factor that Leo has come along in the meantime,
right,
who maybe has made it clear that we want he actually said this, that the original idea of what the Pope meant by that, which was not blessing, you know, unions, but blessing individuals, is what he wants to get back to. I just don't know, but it just seems to me that this is very murky for precisely the reason that you mentioned. It's an ambivalent statement to begin with.
Yeah, Father, I mean, once you have the door open, they're going to open it all the way. I mean, this is what we've seen over the last 50 years, 60 years.
Well, the real solution is Fiducia Supplicans has to be withdrawn, and we have to renounce this false notion that you can bless people as a couple who are engaged in immoral behavior, mortal sin. That's what Fiducia Supplicans is all about. It's a bad document. It needs to be withdrawn, and it's caused immense controversy in the church. We just had the bishops in Africa, you know, discussing this matter again. It is an imposition in life for the church that Pope Francis gave when he did something never done in the history of the world, which is to say that the Catholic Church considers two people who engage in homosexual activity to be a couple and that they can be blessed as a couple. This has to end.
Yeah. In a related story, Pope Leo on October 2nd appointed a pro-LGBT Archbishop, Bernard Longley, to a consultor position at the Dicastery for Promoting Christian Unity under Cardinal Kurt Koch. Longley has overseen the so-called Soho Masses, a pastoral council, a group organizing liturgies for active gays. Bob, what do you make of this appointment and others like it?
It's a disappointment. I think what he's probably doing is hoping that somebody who has the views that this bishop has can enter into dialogue a little bit better with, obviously, other religious groups that are also soft on the gay question. But it just seems to me to be a further step into confusion, into a kind of a coddling of LGBTs in the church that can't possibly go on much longer. I mean, it just seems to me that either we're going to have a clear definition that what we're doing is trying to encourage people to live a Christian life even though they have same-sex attraction, or we're not. And if we're not, then we're really in trouble.
Yeah. The Father, in a related story, partially, there was an historic appointment of the first woman to lead the Church of England, Anglican Bishop of London, Sarah Mullaly, will become the first female Archbishop of Canterbury after she was nominated and approved by King Charles. And then, of course, she'll be the spiritual leader of approximately 85 million Anglicans living in 165 countries. The Archbishop of Westminster, the Catholic Cardinal Vincent Nichols, had this to say: "On behalf of the Catholic Bishops' Conference of England and Wales, I welcome the news of the appointment of Bishop Sarah Mullaly as the next Archbishop of Canterbury. She will bring many personal gifts and experiences to her new role." Father, your reaction to Cardinal Nichols' statement and the appointment? And will this do anything to settle the tensions in the Anglican community over these LGBT issues?
No, it won't settle anything in that regard, nor in regard to abortion. I mean, this is a radical woman who has been made the Archbishop of Canterbury. So she's leading the Anglican Church further in the distance away from the gospel. The moral teaching of Christianity is cast aside in favor of, you know, left-wing ideology in the modern world. So we should be polite and greet them and send them a note saying, you know, pleased to now be in dialogue with you. Yeah. But the dialogue should then go on to the next. Well, why is it that you think abortion's a good thing? You claim to speak in the name of Christ, and you think Jesus is in favor of killing people in the womb? That should be the kind of dialogue we engage in. Otherwise, it's all frippery and show and, you know, happy faces to say everybody likes each other. Yeah. I like everybody. I don't like what everybody thinks and does.
Yeah, me neither. That's why we get along. Finally, on a more positive and colorful note, and gosh, do we need a positive note, on October 4th, 27 new Swiss guards were sworn in at the Vatican. Pope Leo attended the ceremony, the first pope to do so in 60 years. Bob, you studied the Swiss Guard. You've written a book about it. The pope's attendance is how significant?
Oh, I think it's great. If you've never been to the swearing in of the Swiss Guard, it really is that high pageantry of the Vatican. And it reflects something. I think the most noble thing I've ever seen in my life was when Pope Benedict did the Mass. I wrote a book for the 500th anniversary of the Swiss Guard. But Pope Benedict did the Mass for the 500th anniversary under the baldacchino in St. Peter's, and the commandant of the Swiss Guard went up and put his arm after the Mass and walked the Pope down the steps, and the Swiss Guards took their pikes and slammed them on the floor. It just sent chills down your spine. And so there's a tradition there, and it's wonderful that the tradition of guarding the Pope has been honored by the current Pope.
Yeah, well, it needs to continue. Yeah, it's great. I've been to a couple of those ceremonies. They are incredible to see. Father Gerald Murray, Robert Royal, thank you for your time, your commentary. We will leave it there. And you can always find more on thecatholicthing.org or on the Prayerful Posse on the Arroyo Grande podcast. President Trump announced that Israel and Hamas have both signed off on what's being called the first phase of a peace plan to eventually end the war in Gaza. If the agreement holds, it could mean the end of a 2-year bloodshed in the region since those October 7th attacks by Hamas. With analysis of the plan, I'm joined by foreign policy expert, co-host of the War and Freedom podcast, Dr. Waleed Faris. Waleed, thank you for being here. After months of failed negotiation, President Trump announced that the two sides have signed this peace deal, at least the first phase. It was brokered by the president's son-in-law, Jared Kushner, and White House Special Envoy Steve Witkoff. What does that first phase entail? And what about the release of the hostages?
Thank you, Raymond. That phase is the key. I described the whole process, the 20 points that the president put in his plan. as, you know, the key. This phase is the bridge to the key. What does that mean? Israel and Hamas will have to undergo a ceasefire. They are so far, and mostly Israel won't complete an operation it was planning. Hamas will release all hostages, no question, no division. So that is the crossing of the first bridge that would tell the president, that would tell the international community that this operation is over and that Hamas also will be forbidden from doing any military move. But the second bridge, if you allow me, will be the real test. And that is a withdrawal by Israel into almost the borders. And then at the other, on the other side, Hamas will have to start the disarming operation. So when you and I will discuss it, I don't know, weeks from now, we will see if the second operation is going to bring peace or a renewal of what was a disaster in the past.
Waleed, how significant of an achievement is this for the president? There were a lot of people who said this couldn't happen. They're calling President Trump Hitler. Yet here's the biggest and most sought after peace deal really on the international scene right now.
Absolutely. I mean, first of all, Raymond, by comparison between the past president and administration and this president and his administration, there was nothing done between 2021 and 2024, end of 2024. I mean, serious work was not done. Now we see in 9 months, the president being able to convince all sides to put pressure on his Arab friends, to put pressure on his prime minister friend of Israel, Netanyahu, and of course, kind of threatening Hamas. I mean, his words about Hamas were either you do this, either you go through the process or else. What he meant by that, you'll have the treatment that he gave to the regime, Islamic regime of Iran or other places. So that by itself is an achievement. Now, the rest will be linked to how his friends will pressure Hamas. I mean, seriously, you have to have Qatar pressuring Hamas, Turkey pressuring Hamas, Israel committing to allow this to happen, and they are. So this is the biggest achievement that President Trump has done in all of his dealing with the Middle East, with the exception of the Abraham Accord that should come to complete this process.
What was Jared Kushner's role in all this? Do you know?
I don't know the facts, but what we know in the community of experts and people who you know follow this, and those are closer to the Trump camp, mm-hmm. is that Mr. Kushner has been the engineer, one of the engineers of the first Abraham Accord meeting, but also he has been very active with the Saudis, with the Emiratis, with the Qataris. Obviously, in terms of business, he's a private sector person now, but he has success in bringing all these countries together to accept the president's plan. Hmm.
Waleed, what does a strong, durable, everlasting peace deal look like? I mean, we've heard this before, that they have signed peace accords in the past. What makes this agreement different, do you think? Is it?
That's probably the best question in town. Basically, I'm going to make it very simple. The difference between this one and all peace agreements with Egypt, Jordan, the Abraham Accord, UAE, Bahrain, talks with the Saudis is simple. One of the two parties in that conflict, Gaza, is a terrorist organization. All the other, players in previous deals were not terrorists. They were just opposed to each other. The issue here is to make sure that Hamas is disarmed. I mean, people are talking about transforming Gaza into a Riviera, transforming Gaza City into Dubai. Yes, this is the future. But the path to the future, that bridge, the second bridge I was talking about, is really the disarming of Hamas. Once you have that done, then you think about which government should be there, what is the role of the Arabs, of the U.S., the business part of it, the economic part of it, and, of course, the Israeli guarantees. One condition is that there will be no jihadi organization armed in Gaza.
So you're hopeful then that this deal may pass. I mean, I'm going to play you a little clip of this. This is the Patriarch of Jerusalem, who is ecstatic this morning. Watch.
We know very well we have to be very realistic and not naive. But this time, today, is time to rejoice. This news brought a new atmosphere, a new spirit of trust, minimum of trust and hope between within the respective population, Israelis and Palestinians, and this is very important.
Your reaction, Waleed, are you filled with joy today over this?
I do not react that you know, with like people who actually are joyful on the ground. You know, families are joyful, churches, you know, are now happier than before. Moderate Muslims also thanking God that, you know, the war is over. All of that is emotional, and I understand it. It's like at the end of World War II or at the end of any other war. I look at it as a geopolitical analyst. It's a great step. We need to continue to focus. And once the second step is done, like the disarming of Hamas, and then, of course, sitting to negotiate the future, then I'll be happy, but geopolitically, because I would know that there will be no more attacks by any jihadi organization against Israel or against any other minorities in the region. Since the church leaders are speaking now, the real key, not just in Israel and in Gaza with Hamas, everywhere in Syria and Iraq and Iran, once the jihadists are disarmed, that's peace. The rest is history as it is.
Okay, Waleed, we will, of course, stay in touch with you as all of this develops. And if history is any lesson, it will develop. Iran, an Imperialist Republic and U.S. Policy by Dr. Waleed Faris is available at bookstores everywhere and online. Waleed, we'll see you next time. Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And over at the Arroyo Grande podcast, I looked at what is radicalizing young men and how some of them have come back from the edge. It's worth checking out. Then I sat down with the founders of Hondo Rodeo Fest to answer the question, can cowboy culture save America and maybe our boys? James Trawick, Blake Cody, and Bob Coker all share how they created a national rodeo and music festival rooted in God, family, and country. Take a look.
There are so few areas in American culture today where families can together, multi-generations, enjoy the same activity or watch and take part in the same thing. It seems to me, Hondo Rodeo, that's really what you're trying to do.
Absolutely.
Absolutely.
Bob, tell me about that. Talk to me about the vision for this and how it came out of that ethos, that idea.
Well, first of all, our motto is God, family, and country. Huh. So that is what brings family together. And actually, Blake's the guy that had the idea here. We all go to the rodeo, and it is a family event, just like you said.
Yeah.
But only about 10% of the population are rodeo fans.
Why is that? What do you think?
Well, I think it's because they've never been.
Yeah.
So we decided that we wanted to have the best of the best in the rodeo, but how do we get people more than 10% there?
Yeah.
Well, 40 to 50% of the people like country music. So if you get enough good acts to come to an arena, you draw the people, the 40 to 50% of the people, to this act, and if they come early, they see a rodeo, and then they're hooked. And last year in Phoenix, we got hundreds of emails from parents who said, we came because my child loves the Zac Brown Band.
Mm-hmm.
But we got there early. We saw the rodeo. And when it was all said and done, the kids said they liked the rodeo better than the country music. So now we're a rodeo fan, and we'll go to every rodeo we have that's in our area. So what we're doing is working.
The full Arroyo Grande interview with the creators of the Hondo Rodeo Fest is on YouTube at Arroyo Grande Show, or wherever you get your podcasts, Spotify, Apple, iHeart. And be sure to subscribe. You don't want to miss an Arroyo Grande show, and it's free. Of course, be on the lookout for more episodes of the Prayerful Posse there as well. He's a successful award-winning actor, producer, New York Times bestselling author, whose unique career bridges the worlds of entertainment, spirituality, and personal development. He's also starring in a new film, Soul on Fire, based on the life and experience of John O'Leary, who suffered horrific burns in a terrible fire. Through his battle to survive, O'Leary discovers what it means to truly live. Here to tell us about it all is our pal, Devon Franklin. Devon, thanks for being here. And as we were talking about before we came on, you also have that fantastic Ruth and Boaz on Netflix that you produced, which I want people to take a peek at. But Soul on Fire is what we're talking about now. John O'Leary, the subject of the movie, he was burned over 100% of his body in this fire, an accident at his parents' St. Louis home about 40 years ago. How did you come to be a part of this movie?
You know, Raymond, it's good to see you as always. Thanks for having me back.
Sure.
You know, I became a part of this film. I know Sean McNamara, who's the director.
Yep.
And one day he texted me and said, hey, I'd love for you to be in this movie. And along with sending me a script, he sent me a personalized video from the real John O'Leary. And in that video, John O'Leary was expressing to me, you know, why he wanted me to play Nurse Roy, why he thought I would be good for that part. And Nurse Roy is the real nurse that helped rehabilitate John when he was 9 years old after he had gotten burned. And when I read the script and I watched the video from John O'Leary, I just knew that I had to be a part of this film. It's such an uplifting story. Yeah. It's such a family film. And I was really, really just honored that they would think of me and consider me to help bring John's story to life.
Devon, I want to give folks a taste of Soul on Fire. Here's a little clip. This is John's mom speaking to him before he's wheeled into surgery, right after he's burned. Watch.
You're going to have to fight like you've never fought before. And take God's hand and walk with him. And Daddy and I are going to be with you every step of the way.
Devon, as you mentioned, you play Nurse Roy in the movie. How did you prepare for the role? You met with the real Nurse Roy, I assume.
Well, actually, the real Nurse Roy is, I mean, he's truly a servant in that he doesn't want any publicity. It's like he did what he did for John just because that's what he did. So, you know, even, you know, I attempted to reach out to him, but he just said, you know, I don't want to, you know, he doesn't want the spotlight. So what I did was I did a lot of research with other nurses in burn units and really talked to them and to get a better idea of what goes into caring for a burn patient. I read books, you know, about burn units and burn patients to really understand. And one of the things that I discovered through that research is that when you have the type of burns that John O'Leary had when he was 9 years old, that any sort of movement is extremely painful. And that was really important to know so that as I, you know, played the part, I could really, dealing with young John, deal with him with a lot of care and still understand that I had to put him through some pain in order for him to not experience the pain of never walking again. Mm. So preparing for the role was great, and I really had the opportunity to better understand what goes into, you know, caring for patients like this.
Devon, family really is at the center of this movie. John's appreciation for his brother, his four sisters, who ultimately saved his life. There's a unique bond with his dad. How was John's family key to his recovery?
You know, John's family was key to his recovery in the way that so many of our families are key to our recovery when we go through things. They surrounded him. They loved him. They cared for him. They were compassionate with him. And dare I say, they were even tough with him. There's a scene in the movie when John comes home from the hospital and he is, you know, on the road to recovery and he sits down to eat. And if you've seen the film or you've seen the trailer, like, you know, he isn't able to use his hands because the burn has really affected his ability to use his hands. And his sister goes to help him eat. And the mother says no. And she stops the sister from helping him, and the mother makes him learn to eat by himself. In that particular meal, it took him hours to learn. And some may say, oh, well, that was really tough. But what did it do? It helped to prepare him for life. So today, John can, you know, use his hands to eat, to drive, to get dressed, and do all the things that anyone else can do, and that would have never happened if it wasn't for his family that gave him love, but also tough love.
Yeah, and faith is also a key component here. In the movie, the O'Leary family is seen praying grace before meals. His mom and dad pray at the hospital chapel later in the film. John and Beth's wedding was shot at the Shrine of St. Joseph in downtown St. Louis. John's wife, Beth O'Leary, was a former occupational therapist. She's also an essential part of this story. How was her support central to John?
She used to be a contractor.
It was, I think, you know, John would say that, you know, without her support, he wouldn't be where he is and being able to do the things that he's able to do. You know, when you look at how she loved him, you know, there's a beautiful scene in the movie, you know, that when they get married and John O'Leary, you know, takes off his shirt and he wants to turn off the light because of his scars. And she says, no, you know, your scars are you and I love you and I love your scars. And she kisses the scars. And so I think, you know, her support is just everything. And I think when you see their love on screen, it's just reminded that love is, it reminds us that love is one of the most powerful forces, if not the most powerful force in the universe.
Yeah.
And when we give that to one another, that's when the miracles happen.
Yeah, and it really is a story of redemption through pain, through suffering. I mean, that's really at the heart of Soul of Fire. What do you want audiences to take away from the film and your performance in it? You will
walk again. Yeah, you know, I want audiences, first of all, I want, you know, audiences to go to theaters to see this movie. This movie, Soul on Fire, will be in theaters nationwide October 10th. And I want audiences to take their entire family. This is the type of movie you can watch with the youngest all the way to the oldest. You don't have to cover eyes. You don't have to cover ears. Everybody wants Hollywood to make more uplifting films. Well, here it is. Soul on Fire is that film. It is one of the most uplifting films of the year. So I would encourage any family to go see it. You are going to enjoy it. And I would love for people to get from my performance of Nurse Roy the power of compassion. Doing for others what they may not be able to do for themselves, and being of service. Those are the two things that I would love people to take from my performance, because of what Nurse Roy did for young John O'Leary. John O'Leary then had a fighting chance to become the man that he's become. And so often, unsung heroes in our life, the angels in our life, don't always get their just due. But my hope is anyone seeing this film would look at the angel of Nurse Roy and the role he played, and make the decision to become more compassionate and to become, more loving.
Devon, we will leave it there. Soul on Fire, directed by Sean McNamara, starring Devon Franklin, John Corbett, William H. Macy, is now in theaters. For showtimes and tickets in your area, check your local listings or visit soulonfiremovie.com. Thank you, Devon. See you soon.
Thanks, Raymond. Good to see you.
That is all the time we have for now. Be sure to catch us next week. Until then, we'll be scouting the world over for all that is seen and unseen. On behalf of the staff and crew of EWTN News, thanks for watching. I'm Raymond Arroyo. Bye now.